Committee meeting for Monday, February 19th, 2007, and open a public hearing on House Bill 5043, the Department of State Lands. This morning, we will go to public testimony first, and then if should we have time remaining, we will go to the remainder of the budget discussion. The first person up on the agenda, and what I will do is I will go to the people from more than 100 miles away first. Actually, in this particular case, at least one of the two happens to be first on the agenda. So, Gilbert Turnick. Mm-hmm. Mr. Turnick, if you would please come forward. And next up after Mr. Turnick will be Bob, I guess it's Rago. And if you would limit your testimony to about 3 to 5 minutes, it would be appreciated. And please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Wilbur Turnick, and I live in Florence, Oregon, and I work as a wetland consultant with my son. I'm 81 years old, and I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to come over here, but I think it's extremely important to testify on this particular budget, and it's not just because I work in wetlands. Long time ago, I promised Tom McCall I would do everything I could as chairman of the Coastal Commission to work towards protecting salt marshes. And this is part of the commitment that I have. And we have a real problem the last few years with DSL. And it gets around to the backlog of projects that haven't been put through. And part of that is the reason they don't have adequate staff to do it. And two of the other bills that I testified on and I support in my testimony is 2106 and 2105, which establishes some extra money to get some staff to get the backlog of projects caught up. And I firmly believe that the new leadership that has been put in place in DSL is top of the line. And I believe we'll get there. But the element that is key to every project of any kind throughout history is having an adequate budget. If you don't have that foundation, you just can't get it done. So I came here to testify. I'm not going to read my testimony. I would like to have it included in the record of the meeting.
It will be so included.
I would like to have... Joyce, could you get there a couple of those over there? This is those salt marshes I'm talking about, and it's the key. Other people here are much more knowledgeable than I am that will testify today, I'm sure. But this is in the Halem Bay salt marshes. They're still there. That most of the salt marshes on the Oregon coast, a vast amount of them, have been already covered up, diked off, and they're not there anymore. And we really need to do something about it, and that's what I'm working on right now. One of the primary needs we need on the Oregon coast, and we need it from Astoria all the way to Brookings, is mitigation banks. We don't have any. And because of that, and a rule that's in DSL which says that if you impact a wetland, you have to do in-kind mitigation. Now, I'm going to do a lot of them in the Florence area because the real estate frenzy that's going on. And there are dunal depressions, and they come and go with the cycles of hydrology. But because I wipe out or impact one of those, then I have to do in-kind. I don't do that anymore. I would like to be able to do that in either a mitigation bank or a project in the marshes, which is the largest loss we've had on the coast. But until that change comes, I'm prohibited from doing that. Hopefully that can be addressed either by an administrative rule or legislative action up here. I don't have time to talk about, because 5 minutes, You're giving me more time than I got in Washington, D.C. I only got three back there.
Anyway, what a great chair.
Some of the other problems, you know, well, you really have non-existent violation enforcement right now, at least in the area where I'm at. And that gets back to staff again, which is budget. The Corps of Engineers just hired an enforcement officer in the Eugene District, which will help. And I'm sure Louise will have somebody over on the coast, too. So these things, hopefully, somewhere in the future here, one of the committees over here will talk about the whole operation and the different problems in it. It's not appropriate that I bring all those up here today, but I do want to emphasize the last part of my testimony, which says that the reason I'm here is I fully support the budget for DSL.
Thank you very much.
Give me that one here. If I can just take one more second. This is a pretty important wetland. In fact, it would qualify for a statewide significant wetland, no doubt about it. The entire wetland that my son is standing in here is scheduled for destruction by the Forest Service. No permit, no delineation, nothing. And when we asked the ranger at a public meeting why he didn't get a permit, he said, well, we thought about it, it would take too long. My question, where is federal consistency and why isn't it enforced? Thank you.
Thank you. The next person up is, and I'm hoping I pronounced the name correctly, Bob Regal from...
I can't write very well. Reagan.
Oh, okay. Looks like an H.
Like I said, my handwriting needs some work.
Okay. And again, if you keep your testimony to 3 to 5 minutes.
I'll do my best. These remarks are in reference to HB 5043.
Okay, and if you would identify yourself again.
My name is Robert Regan. I am Executive Director of Douglas Timber Operators, a regional forest products trade association in Roseburg. We represent mills, loggers, and timberland owners in Lane, Coos, and Douglas counties. I'm here today to register our concerns about the proposed management plan for the Elliott State Forest that we believe shortchanges Oregon schools. We recognize that the management of this common school fund asset is the responsibility of the state land board, but the legislature has to do the heavy lifting of funding schools throughout our state. The less the Elliott provides for school funding, the more must be made up in general revenues that are at times in short supply. This past year, the Board of Forestry allowed us to make several modeling runs for the Elliott so that we could demonstrate the opportunity cost of the state's pursuit of a habitat conservation plan for that forest. This HCP will last for 55 years, provides no-touch reserves on 27% of the forest, and severe harvest constraints on the balance. We developed two modeling runs, one which managed the Elliott under the Oregon Forest Practices Act as if it were privately owned. We then ran a more constrained alternative to provide greater protection of spotted owls, similar to what the state does on the Tillamook State Forest. In the handout I provided, the top graph, this one here, shows the return on asset value for the intermediate alternative and ESF is the state's proposed plan. Please note in the first decade that the ESF plan generates less than a 3% return on asset value and drops to 2% by the end of the proposed HCP 55 years. The intermediate alternative returns around 5%. The State Land Board just adopted new guidance for return on asset values for state forests. It ranges from 3 to 5%. The Elliott does not achieve this rather low target range. Certainly the folks who depend on PERS for their retirement wouldn't be very happy if the Elliott part of their asset pool. Neither should Oregon schools. The bottom graph shows a change in standing merchantable timber inventory over the planning horizon of 150 years. The top line is the state's plan. The middle line is the intermediate alternative, and the bottom line is for the baseline run, assuming the Elliott were in private ownership. The simple reason the state's plan returns on asset is so low is that much of the growth of the forest goes into inventory. The only way the asset can provide a return is for the trees to be sold and harvested. Within the 55-year term of the proposed HCP, the standing inventory will climb from 2.3 billion board feet to 3.2 billion board feet. The second page of the handout is a graph depicting who owns the forest in Oregon. The large tree on the left is federal ownership of our state, representing the national forests and the ONC lands. The next two trees represent private ownership, the first dark tree being industrial timberland ownership. The next lighter green tree is small woodlot ownership. The following two trees way down here on the bottom, the first is state forests, and the final is tribal forest ownership. The Elliott, which would comprise about one-third of that state forest ownership. My purpose in highlighting this ownership is to point out that the federal forests are over 55% of our total forested lands, and they are largely set aside for non-timber harvest. That is the reason we are having the debate in Congress today about how to fund rural Oregon counties and schools who now heavily depend on renewal of the safety net for financial support. The other point is that with all that land in wildlife reserves, almost all of this is off limits to harvest, why would the state of Oregon and the Elliott follow a similar guidance that would set aside much of the forest for wildlife habitat, especially in a forest that is dedicated to funding our schools? Thank you so much for your time. I'm pleased to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Yes.
So when you're talking about board feet, how many acres in the Elliott, and how many board feet are you going to end up under the state's plan versus
the alternatives that we developed?
Yeah.
Well, the state's plan calls on harvesting about 40 million feet a year. The plan that we developed would harvest between 50 and 55 million board feet per year. The problem with the state's plan is even though they raise the harvest, the revenue stream is no different than where it is today because they're into more expensive harvesting systems and harvesting less valuable trees. And so even though they're planning on raising the cut, the revenue stream is the same as it's been under the existing plan. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Mr. Leonard, in my part of the country, I've visited a place called Limber Jim. The Limber Jim Forest is a federal project out in our part of the country. And they were doing a project where they weren't treating the land. You could not walk through it. There was so much material. I thought he said there was 100 tons of material. And in the event of a forest fire, it was just going to... Well, you should have like 20 or 25 tons of material on in a forest of acres. Is that, am I someplace in the ballpark? Or what?
Oh, yeah, it all depends on the growth potential of the site. And over here on this side of the Cascades, our forests grow much more quickly, and we can have 100 tons per acre of forest mass on per acre. What we have on the Elliott is we have trees that are this big around, 200 feet tall, that originated from a fire in 1868. This forest burned up in 1868. These are naturally grown Douglas fir forests, and we're just continuing to add that to that inventory. The current inventory, the 2.3 billion feet, we could harvest at today's rate for 100 years and not capture any of the growth. There's that much volume out there, and we're adding to it. And anyway, excuse me.
Now we know that the federal government isn't going to help with our schools, and with that $220 million, how is that going to affect our budgeting for all of this?
That's a pretty big question, Senator Nelson. Probably would have to be.
A big question. We better answer it. It's a big question. That's what I'm thinking. Because we got $220 million we're going to have to fill a hole on an annual basis. That's $440 million on a biennial basis. How are we going to fill that hole for our schools? To me, that's the question we're going to be talking about.
Representative Berard, and then we're going to have to actually move on because we're getting... Please proceed.
Mr. Reagan, what do you propose in board feet that we cut?
Based on the modeling runs that we used, I think that we could sustain under a take avoidance strategy, in other words, complying with the Endangered Species Act without large reserves, around 50 million feet, which is where the forest was harvesting prior to the beginning of the HCP back in 1994. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ray Wilkerson. Sorry to cut off the debate, but we've got a long list here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council, and I'll be brief and yield back part of my 3 to 5 minutes to the others who have signed up to testify. I just wanted to make a couple comments about the Elliott State Forest also. I'm mindful of Senator Vakian's reminder the other day that this is a budget committee, not a policy committee, but clearly that's a line that's not a bright line, and policy and budget issues get mixed up all the time. And I think clearly here there is a nexus between the management of this forest and the budget, because for every additional dollar that this forest can generate through timber sales is one less dollar that you have to appropriate to K-12 from the general fund and can be used for other state programs. So I think it is appropriate for this committee to be considering and be aware of and mindful of how this asset is being managed. Also like to echo Representative Clem's comment the other day that there's a private sector side to this too, and for every additional job that's generated from timber harvesting on the Elliott State Forest, that's not only a family wage job that supports an Oregon family, but also generates additional income tax revenues for the state budget as well. Like Mr. Reagan, we believe that the current management of the Elliott State Forest is quite a bit below what it could be on a sustainable basis. The agency, if they get an HCP, would be up to 40 million board feet a year, but they're currently less than 30, and that's far short of what this asset is capable of producing. And finally, I'd like to, this is important, I'd like to echo what Representative Burley said the other day at the end of the previous hearing, that we don't blame the Louise Soliday for this at all. She inherited this situation just recently, and in addition to that, she's not the decider. The land board is the decider, and I think it's an open question to the extent to which the legislature can tell the land board what to do. I'm not sure if that's legally possible or not, but I think if this committee and the legislature in general signal to the land board that there's some serious questions about the management of this valuable state asset, I think the land board would listen. So I hope that you take a good look at this and consider the testimony that you're going to hear. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Liz Frankel will be the next person up. Could please identify yourself for the record.
Yes. Liz Frankel, League of Women Voters of Oregon, and I do have written testimony. Sorry about that. But I'm not going to read it to you entirely, but I'm going to say two things. One is the League has been extremely concerned over the years with the confusion about what's policy. And I have to say that we are not discussing the Common School Fund or the Elliott in this particular support of the budget. Basically, what we want to say is that we support, in particular, two job positions required for wetland delineation reviews, the payment to provide specialists, an additional position for South SLU, the state's grandest protected wetland and estuary area, and finally, we wish it were really finally, League of Women Voters of Oregon supports three new positions critical to the Portland Harbor Superfund, and we wish it were final. That said, it was very interesting to me, the two positions that the League has. We have national positions and we have state positions. The national position is just super for anything we want to do. The state position is really blunt. It starts out by saying the League of Women Voters wants clean water. They're just very blunt. And then it goes on to add, and we support in particular the ability of the agency to enforce whatever is needed in terms of getting clean water. And partly that's when we're talking about clean water, after all, wetlands, the wetland programs, a lot of what DSL does depends on their ability to enforce, but their ability to enforce depends upon technical support, monitoring, all of these things. For example, the payment to provide program, which was something that I was involved in very early. Payment to provide, if you remember on the coast in the early days, they simply lined up little lots all along the coast. Those little lots, probably half of them were in wetlands. But you can't, there's no way you can mitigate for these little tiny lots. And that's how we came to a payment to provide program whereby you could buy your way out, provided, and then we get into mitigation banks. All of that depends upon technical support, staff support, determining what is real, because the state does have a policy, no net loss. And you can't just say, I think. It's got to be real, on the ground, serviceable, gain, loss. And it has to balance. That's state policy. We support that. The league supports the budget. And I just want to say again, I do think that we have to be very careful not to be dealing with, for example, the forestry issues here now. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have a panel which will consist of Chuck Bennett, Jim Green, and Lori Wimmer Whalen. And as you can determine your own order, and as each of you speak, would you identify yourselves for the record, and would you limit yourself to 3 to 5 minutes? And I'd want to say how happy it I was to see school boards and COES and OEA all at the same table. Agreed.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to add, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. To add to your delight, we're not only at the same table, we'll have the same message, which is very, very strong support, again, this session, for the budget from the Department of State Lands. The added positions included in the budget, we believe, are necessary. We can only, I think, as a group, praise the department. We've been working with them closely for the past 3 sessions in what can only be described from a stakeholder's perspective, a really ideal relationship in terms of their willingness to keep us informed and include us in a variety of decision-making processes that they go through. As you know, we're the beneficiaries of the Commons, represent those, which quite simply are the kids of Oregon, as the beneficiaries of the Common School Fund. We couldn't be more pleased with the work the department has done to provide us with what has become one of the really significant local revenue sources that arrive at school districts. We are expecting the fund to provide upwards of $100 million in the next biennium, which is, by any estimation, is a really substantial change from where the Common School Fund was just 8 years ago. This has become a really important resource to local districts. At the same time, we've been able to work with them. For those of you who've been on this committee for a while know that I've been in on these bills now for the past couple of sessions, joining others at local government and in the timber industry, urging increased production on the Elliott State Forest. We continue to believe that that's an important part of the Common School Fund's asset base. I had the opportunity over the past year and a half to serve on the department's asset allocation and management committee, and I can only tell you that we came in with a very strong message of aggressive management on the Elliott. We got, I think, as far as we can in terms of aggressive management of the Elliott in the face of all of the limitations imposed by the federal government, as well as a very clear policy from the state land board, and one we agree with, that there are additional resources to be maintained on the Elliott State Forest. We're very proud of the decision of the department as well as the land board to take a more aggressive cutting, develop a more aggressive cutting policy on the Elliott. We're pleased that they set up a local advisory committee, included local school administrators who agree with us that this needs to be and is an important part not only of the Common School Fund but also of the local economy. In addition, we believe that without additional employees, it is very difficult for the department to meet its objectives of providing maximum income to the Common School Fund, particularly in rangeland and property management areas. There are very exciting activities underway at the department as they try to capture lands that, in lieu of lands that replace lands lost to the Common School Fund early in statehood. We're looking at some real development opportunities out there. But ultimately, the bottom line with the Common School Fund is that it is being invested in the equities market, and that's where the action is. All the rest of the values, the rest of the money, the rest of the income absolutely pales against the equity market income, and it was that change that really changed the scope of this fund and its relationship to local revenue stream to our school district. So we, along with the department, certainly appreciate the hard work that's been done by the state treasurer's office in such successful investment. Again, we try to testify regularly at the land board on issues of interest to us and meet regularly with department staff to go over issues of importance to us as beneficiaries of the fund. And just, again, we just can't recommend this budget to you more highly or this agency.
Thank you. Next, identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing Oregon Education Association and its 46,000 member teachers, education support professionals, and community college faculty. Chuck has given you the bulk of all of our testimony in his wise words, and I consider him to be more of the expert of the at least compared to me, on this particular budget. But we, too, are here in support of the DSL budget and also the agency and representing teachers. I'll say it's because of the three R's, relationships, resource management, and revenues. And you've heard how well they've done in all of those. We really do feel as though we are partners with them, and we do feel that the kinds of changes they've made over the years to reach out to the education community and to provide resources for the Common School Fund through their management practices has been really a success story that ought to be better told, I think, publicly, because citizens can be proud of this agency. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon School Boards Association. I'd only echo what my friends here at the table have said. One of the things that I think is very telling about how well this agency is doing and what it's doing for boys and girls as it relates to the Common School Fund is the chart that they provided you today. If you take a look just 10 years ago, in 1996, the Common School Fund distribution to schools was less than $10 million.
In 2006, we're going to look at a distribution in excess of $50 million. It went from a fund that had assets in 1996 of just over $400 million to now a fund that has more than $1 billion of common school fund principal in it. And I think that's a tribute to what the State Land Board has done and what the department has done. And that, those funds are distributed to school districts, and they're important, valuable dollars that we need in our classrooms in order to do what we do for boys and girls across the state. We're with them on a variety of bills that you're going to hear about this session, because I know for COSA, and I'm pretty sure OEA is on board with us as well, that we will do whatever we can to grow the Common School Fund and get those distributions out of those dollars and get the best return we can for the lands that are there, whether it's fill and removal fee permits or that timber harvest that occurs on the Elliott Forest and other state lands. We want to make sure that those funds get into the Common School Fund and get distributed out as they were originally set up to when we were created as a state over 150 years ago.
Next up will be John Charles.
My name is John.
Oh, please proceed.
My name is John Charles, representing Cascade Policy Institute, research organization, and I've followed the Elliott State Forest on and off for about the last 12 years, and I would like to briefly focus on something that you discussed a couple of days ago. I listened to all your previous work on audio tapes over the weekend, and I know that there was a discussion of the net operating income on the Elliott that has been high and is projected to be, the net operating income is going to drop because of rising management costs on the Elliott. And that becomes, that's where the line between policy and budget becomes blurred. I'd like to read a quote from the asset management plan that focuses on this issue, which says, largely due to costs associated with protecting endangered species, expenditures incurred by DOF in management of the common school forest lands have increased significantly over the past 9 years, reducing net revenues to the common school fund. The ratio of expenses to revenues has increased consistently during the study period, increasing by 1 percentage point annually on average. This trend is expected to continue, even though revenues from timber sales are anticipated to remain constant in the short term. Now, what's interesting about that statement is that it's not from the current asset management plan. It's from the draft 1995 asset management plan. So this issue of rising management costs relative to timber revenues has been going on for close to 20 years. Now, I know that Ms. Holliday has said that the fact that revenues will be cut by about 50%, well, costs will be about 50% of revenues over the next 2 years, is sort of a blip, and then it'll come down. And I know that they intend for that to happen. But how long are you going to wait for your ship to come in? This is a 20-year trend of costs going up relative to revenues, and I think there's something systemically wrong here that is not about the management people within the agency. It's the problem of the way the public sector manages relative to private. Now, this little graph I handed out kind of captures the problem that, yes, the rising asset value in the Common School Fund has been a great success story. It's gone up in the last 15 years by more than 200%. But notice the blue line, the Elliott, at one time in 1995, it was estimated conservatively to be worth about $850 million, possibly $1 billion. And then by 2005, it had plummeted to somewhere between $250 and $450 million because the people who did the estimate assumed the same compliance strategy with the ESA that you've heard about, which is an overly conservative strategy. Now, the success story of the gold bars here, the CSF, comes because it's not the DSL or the State Land Board. It's Oregon Investment Council contracts out management of most of its assets. They hire the best talent in the world to manage these assets, and their track record is phenomenal. I wish they could manage my money. Well, the LSA forest, that doesn't happen. We have the DOF do it, and the result is just the opposite. So I don't think that's going to change, and I think the beneficiaries of this trust obligation, school kids, are being shortchanged. So my recommendation is that you either put in as a performance measure that these management costs drop significantly, certainly below the 47% projected for the next biennium, to something less than 25%, or you seriously consider selling off the Elliott, as was recommended in 1994 by the late John Buter, one of the more prominent forest analysts in the state, when he said on contract to DOF, selling the Elliott is the only marketing alternative likely to significantly increase net annual income to the common school fund. The market value for the forest is not likely to be less than $600 million, and it could well be in the neighborhood of $1 billion. Even allowing for the cost of selling the forest, the endowment resulting from the sale of the forest could be expected to yield a net annual income of $30 to $50 million per year. No amount of cost reduction or timber merchandising could ever be expected to make up the difference between that and the estimated $16 million per year of the preferred alternative at that time. And it's ironic to me that I think today there's even a rally scheduled for school funding, and you have an asset that could be worth $1 billion or more, and we're not getting the revenue off of it that we could. And you don't really know what something is worth until you allow a market to function. I'll just say in closing that last year the state of Indiana privatized, or actually leased on a long-term lease, their toll road, and they estimated beforehand it might bring in $1.8 billion. That was just an estimate. The best minds thought it might be worth $1.8 billion. When they actually put it out to market, they found someone was willing to pay almost $4 billion. So we don't know what the Elliott's really worth. We should find out. And just like the assets in the Common School Fund, if private management of it, private ownership of it, can bring more net revenue to the Common School Fund for students, then I think that's what we should do. In fact, I think it's clear we have a constitutional mandate to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Another name that I'm going to probably mispronounce. It's either Jimmy Kagan or it's Reagan. One of those. Okay. Please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Jimmy Kagan. I work at the Institute for Natural Resources at OSU. I manage both the information program at the Institute and the Oregon Natural Heritage Information Center. I'm going to provide just a few brief points that are covered in the written testimony that I provided. The first point relates to the Natural Heritage Advisory Council budget. It's a very small part of DSL's budget, although it's a significant part, I think, of the general funds that the agency gets. And as the manager of the Natural Heritage Information Center, I currently provide staff support to the Natural Heritage Advisory Council under an interagency agreement between OSU and DSL. And that support allows the council to both manage the state natural areas program, to work with Fish and Wildlife Service to help conserve at-risk invertebrates and butterflies, and to develop a plan to conserve Oregon's natural heritage. The limited funding allows the council to meet quarterly to update the plan and to obtain and distribute the federal funding. And the state receives very important benefits out of this very limited investment. The second point I want to speak to briefly is about a policy option package that I don't believe you've gotten to yet in your hearing, which is POP 112 for fill and removal permit streamlining. POP 112 is part of a larger effort to streamline the process of getting water-related permits in Oregon. If funded, we believe this POP will make it both easier to obtain fill and removal permits and also make it easier for the public to protect the environment. INR has a primary mission to bring together natural resources information and create tools to do just this. It includes funding to create and make a tool available. It would be a web-based application. It'll allow a landowner or a prospective developer to determine if a site has environmental problems in advance of submitting fill and removal permit applications before they spend money on designing a development or even buy the property. The web tool would allow anybody to learn if any specific piece of property or site had known wetlands, endangered species, or other environmental problems which occurred on the property or nearby. Pre-screening school could help identify problems in advance, which could slow the permit process and hopefully allow people to avoid sensitive sites more easily. It would also alert developers if specific inventories or delineations would be required, and at the same time provide regulators in many agencies with real-time data. This application is part of the Oregon Explorer Natural Resource Digital Library Project, which is cooperatively being developed by INR and OSU Libraries. Initially, it'll focus on wetland fill and removal permits, but we believe it'll be widely usable for people to pre-screen lots of other projects. And the funding for this thing is coming from lots of sources, not just this POP, from foundations, from federal agencies, and it's being created with the help of many partners. This overall effort is part of a larger project between DSL, OSU, the Wetlands Conservancy, and other conservation organizations and federal and state agencies to streamline the process of working with natural resource agencies in Oregon to restore and conserve important places in Oregon while promoting sustainable economic development. To do this, agencies realize they need to do a better job of collecting their information, making it available to the public, and other agencies in creating more efficient ways of dealing with the public. The focus at INR is to assist agencies such as DSL in integrating information and making it available and creating tools to improve natural resource management in the state. Thanks very much for your time and attention.
Thank you. I believe we'll go now to the last person that has signed up, Esther Lev.
For the record,
if you could move closer to the microphone.
I'm Esther Lev with the Wetlands Conservancy, and I'm here in support of DSL's budget. And the Wetlands Conservancy is a statewide NGO with a mission of conservation of Oregon's wetlands. About 5 years ago, because DSL is so small staffed, a lot of their focus has been on their regulatory effort. So 5 years ago, the Wetlands Conservancy launched a program called Oregon's Greatest Wetlands to identify where the state's most significant wetlands are and how to begin to work to allow conservation of those. With this budget and with the new leadership at DSL, I think that we can work real strongly to bring the nonprofit sector, the state agencies and federal agencies and the business community together to have a really model wetland conservation program. So I support this budget because I think it will move us in that direction.
Thank you very much. That is our final person scheduled to testify. We will be at ease for about 2 minutes while the department gets ready to present the rest of their budget. So. restart, and we do not have a quorum, but this is budget presentation portion of this process and hearing, so we don't actually need a quorum. So with that, please begin your testimony again, Ms. Soliday.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. First, I provided a packet of additional information for you today that you requested last Wednesday. The first thing in the packet is the current State Land Board adopted distribution policy, and it was updated in 2005. The Land Board made a change to use a three-year rolling average in order to reduce the spikes up and down in the distributions that are made to school districts and to provide some more certainty. And then we provided a chart showing the increase in the value of the Common School Fund going back to 1991, a chart that shows the distributions to school districts going back to 1990, and this has the updated projections for the 07-09 biennium, which reflects the $109.4 million distribution rather than the $71.5 million that was in assumed in the governor's recommended budget. And then the last chart is the historical performance net of fees, which was provided by the Office of the State Treasurer. I mean, you can see that over the last 4 years, we've had extremely nice returns and growth in the Common School Fund after a period of negative numbers. So,
I do see from the presentation that you provided us or the on the distribution policy that it does appear to be a fairly aggressive policy to sort of improve the corpus of the principle of the fund. So,
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The Land Board, when they adopted the base of this policy several years ago, had that discussion about how much growth do you want to have versus how much you want to get out to schools, and decided to try and balance that to make sure that we were getting distributions and hopefully increasing distributions over time, but at the same time to continue to grow the corpus of the fund so that we would have more revenues available for distribution over time. And I think what's happened with distributions, I think, speaks to the success of that policy.
Please proceed.
Great. We're going to pick up with policy option package 108, which is our capital improvement budget. There is a proposed $337,000 increase in our capital improvement fund. Those funds would be used for land sales and appraisals related to this set of lands that we've identified for disposal, both rangelands and forest lands. It would be used for noxious weed treatments on our common school fund lands, particularly in southeast Oregon. It would be used for rangeland analysis. We have been collecting data on our rangelands, about 30,000 acres a year, but we have not done an analysis of that data. We now have about 180 or 190,000 acres worth of data, so we want to contract with somebody to actually do an analysis of that data to help us with updating our management plans. And the last project we want to do with this capital improvement money is also forest land analysis, and speaks to some of the issues that were raised during the public testimony. We do want to look at our costs as well as our management of our forest lands to see if there are some things that we should be doing differently than we're currently doing or proposing to do in the future. So those are the capital dollars that are in Package 108. Package 110, Mr. Chair, I'll do two of these at a time, which is what we were doing last week.
That would be fine.
Package 110 is our e-commerce and our package to streamline our internal processes. There is one FTE associated with this. What we are working towards in the department is a couple of things. First is a paperless file system. We are taking up quite a bit of space in our office complex for storage of files. We have an entire file room on our first floor as well as several storage rooms that we're using for files. The goal is to get those files on electronic systems so that we have an electronic filing system. people will have access to it, the public as well as our staff, when they're out in the field, instead of having to carry big paper files, they will have access to those electronically. We also are hoping through this package to continue to look at ways to streamline our permitting efforts. We want to automate more of our processes. We've gone to an automated public review process. We want to also see if we can automate our payment process for people who have leases, people who are applying for permits and leases, those sorts of things, figure out a way that we can begin to accept credit card payments, those sorts of things. So there are a number of things that are built into this package to get our electronic systems updated and staff in place so that we can continue to maintain those over a period of time.
Any questions on policy option package 108 and 110? Just curious. Put you in a bad position, Ms. Soliday. What was 109?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to come back to that at the very end because it's one that we've actually been given permission to request at the table.
Yeah, you're not the only one, actually. <It's unfortunate. laughs> Any questions? Okay, we'll go on to 111 and 112.
POP 111 is the package that is associated with House Bill 2106, and that's the bill that would allow us to establish a new fee for wetland delineation reviews. That fee would provide enough funding to fund two new FTEs to add to our wetland staff. We would ensure that all wetland delineation reviews, the initial reviews, would be done within 120 days. Right now we have a backlog, a fairly significant backlog of wetland delineations that our staff is not getting to. We prioritize those that come in where we already have a permit application in the door or we are expecting a permit application within 90 days. So we are getting to those in a timely manner, but all others that come in, we're not. And so people are not able to actually plan ahead for the kinds of development that they want to do, knowing for certain where the wetlands are on the property that they want to develop. And what we want to try and do is get this process at the front end so that the delineations are done before people complete their designs and come into us with a permit application. So this is the package that would support those two new FTE, and we believe that will give us enough staff to address the backlog and then on an ongoing basis respond to all those delineation requests for delineation reviews within 120 days. And then POP 112, is the package that is associated with House Bill 2251. That is our streamlining bill that we developed in response to a budget note that several agencies got in 2005 to look to see if there was a way to better integrate and coordinate the state authorizations that are needed from the various state agencies if you're doing activities in waters of the state. This is what we call the RIPIT project, which is the Water-Related Permit Process Improvement Team project. State agencies have been meeting since the 2005 session to look at ways to better coordinate and integrate the permitting process. We've identified up to 11 state authorizations that we believe we can integrate into the removal fill permit at DSL. The package asks for one additional FTE, and there is $200,000 built into here to help with the information that Jimmy Kagan spoke to during the public testimony, and that is to provide the resource information to applicants up front, where the wetlands are, where we have endangered species, other resources that are important for folks to try to avoid as they're considering various development options. So there is both a staff to DSL and a contract, enough money for contract to provide on a web-based database information to all of our applicants and to anybody in the public who wants to use that information.
Any questions on 111 or 112? Hearing none, please go on to 113 and 114.
POP 113 is a request for an internal auditor. This is, I think, the third biennium in a row we've made this request. We are out of compliance with the DAS policy that requires an agency such as ours to have an internal auditor. Given the amount of funds that flow through the department, we think it's very important to have an internal auditor position. We also believe that person will be able to help us further streamline our internal processes, help us identify areas where we can make some changes in how we're operating our internal systems. And that's one FTE. And then POP 114 is a request for a contract financial assistant at South SLU National Estuarine Research Reserve. Currently, this work is being done by a manager and makes it difficult. She's trying to do two jobs. And so given the volume of contracts and grants that South SLU uses during the course of a biennium, we believe this position is necessary to manage and handle the large number of reports, both financial and narrative, that need to be done associated with those grants. This person also will help with procurement at South SLU. They are based in Charleston, and we think it makes sense to have a person located right in Charleston with the program to do that instead of us trying to do it out of Salem, which isn't always very efficient. And that's a request for one FTE, and it would be supported 50% by the federal funds that they get from the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration and half from the Common School Fund.
Questions on 113 and 114? Please proceed. 115.
Mr. Chair, POP 115 is our request for Portland Harbor and critical cleanup. As I mentioned when we talked about our budget drivers, we have both proprietary and regulatory responsibilities in Portland Harbor. It does appear as though the record of decision is going to get delayed beyond 2008. However, we still have a need to get site histories done for the parcels which we have leased over the last 100 or 150 years to try to identify who were in those leases and what kinds of businesses they were engaged in to identify whether or not they may have been contributors to the problems that are in Portland Harbor. We also have several other sites around the state that need cleanup action as well. And so this is a request for three FTE, a manager, an information system support staff person, and an office specialist two position so that we have a team that is working with current staff specifically dedicated to Portland Harbor and our cleanup efforts. This package also includes a request for 3,200 hours of senior AG time, Attorney General office time, and that's because we are relying fairly heavily on them for legal advice related to our responsibilities, both proprietary and regulatory, in the Superfund area. And the goal here is to actually get an attorney general who has experience dealing with Superfund cleanups around the country.
Before we go on to the next one, I had one question. I know what the answer, I believe, is, but just to get it on the record. The three FTE, what's the source of the other funds?
Mr. Chair, that would be Common School Fund. And there may be, as a part of the Portland Harbor cleanup, an opportunity for cost recovery of those funds over time. We're not far enough down the road yet to know whether that's the case.
You can see why, Ms. Holliday, you can see why some people might believe that that's probably a questionable use of Common School Funds.
Mr. Chair, we are the owner of the lands in the Portland Harbor, the submerged and submersible lands, and the Common School Fund is our source of funding.
I understand that. but I believe there are some people that believe that obviously that some of the parties that are responsible, that are still around to be responsible, hold some responsibility for that.
Mr. Chair, I'd agree. And there will be a whole a rather large process, given the size of Portland Harbor, to determine who the potentially responsible parties are and to go through. There will be a long negotiations on cost allocation. Our goal is to hold the Common School Fund harmless, and if there is an opportunity to recover our costs, to also recover those costs from the responsible parties.
Any additional questions? Seeing none, go on to your one.
Oh, 116.
Yes.
Package 116 is a request for a position for our payment to provide a fund. We have a wetland mitigation revolving fund. Those funds come from people who have small impacts, less than 0.2 acre impact in terms that require mitigation. And instead of having those people actually do mitigation on the ground because it would be so small in size and it would be questionable value, we allow those folks to pay into this fund. That fund currently has over $2.1 million in it. We have been unable to get that money out on the ground due to lack of staffing for that program, and so we are requesting an FTE that we can pay for out of the fund so that we can get a program set up and get those dollars out on the ground, because those dollars are supposed to be used to do mitigation, and we want to get them out on the ground funding wetland restoration projects around the state. And that money would come directly out of the fund itself.
Any questions? Let's go to 117.
And 117, which is our last regular pop, that is a request for an additional FTE in our asset management section. Given the new asset management plan and all of the tasks that we have identified in there that need to be done over the next 10 years, we are requesting an additional FTE who can help to prepare sales of lands that are going to happen for the rangelands and forest lands that we've identified, who can help with the planning efforts that we have going in Central Oregon and for our rangelands, and also help with the work that we're doing to try to get the remainder of the in lieu lands that the state is owed from the federal government. And that is one FTE that would be paid for with Common School Fund funds.
Any questions at this point? Yes, Representative Garrard.
Felice, do you expect a return on the investment of all these FTEs and all these various things to the school fund?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garrard, we do over time. We think it's going to take a little bit of time here to get staffed up and to start doing some of the prep work to begin generating revenue, but we do believe that in out biennium, the goal is to have significant increases in the amount of revenue, particularly off of industrial, commercial, residential opportunities that we've identified in Central Oregon. But we've got to go through master planning. We've got to wait until some of those come into urban growth boundaries. So there's some time that it's going to take for us to get there. But absolutely, over time, we believe we're going to see some significant increase in revenues into the school fund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I guess we can go on to other requests. And,
So, Mr. Chair, here's where POP 109 went. It is the first one that's on this list, and that is a request for $100,000 in other funds for our comprehensive annual financial audit that we need to do. Back in 2005, the State Comptroller's Office reclassified the Common School Fund, and as a result of that, we are now the largest fund in that classification, and as a result, we need to have a comprehensive audit done every year. And we, this biennium, have put off doing some cleanup work that we were otherwise planning to do because we did not have budget to pay for those audits, and so we do two a biennium. The cost of those come in right around $100,000 to do two of them, and so we are requesting other funds limitation for the purpose of paying for those two audits that we have done each biennium.
Solid. Would those two audits be done by the Secretary of State's office?
Mr. Chair, they are.
They are. Okay. And it's not directly a related question, but in reading through this and other materials over the weekend, I saw the whole discussion about the differences in between your balances
for the unclaimed property and what the state's financial system says what the balance should be, and something in there that says by, I believe, July of this year, they should be all reconciled.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. This is a problem that we knew about before the 2006-5 audit and the 2006 audit. It's a problem we have been working on, and that is to reconcile the balance that is in the state's financial system with the balance that's in the what we call the wager system, which we use for unclaimed property, in terms of how much we're actually holding in assets in the unclaimed property accounts. And we have we started out with a fairly significant difference between those two. As a result of work we've done to date, we're down to about $3 million difference between those two. We're continuing to work on that problem, and we do hope by later this year to have that number reconciled to the extent that we can. I don't know that we'll ever get 100% there. Some of the records go back 50 or more years on those, but we will get as close to zero as we can as we continue to try and reconcile those.
I hate to ask a policy question in a ways and means. But in terms of unclaimed property, and I know that a lot of your unclaimed property is bank accounts that are left, usually with relatively small balances. Do you have any sort of minimum amount in statute that you no longer have to track that would just simply go to the state? Because I can think of, you must have tens of thousands, you know, of small $7.23, $5.21 balances.
Mr. Chair, we have over a million data sets in our database for unclaimed property. We do not have a minimum amount that we eliminate. Yeah, we do not have a minimum amount. We keep those on our books. They're available for claim over time. They stay in the fund, and the records are there for people to come forward to claim those accounts. We do different levels of trying to locate people depending on the amount of money, so we don't spend time trying to locate people if we have less than $50 for them. Their names are available on our website, so anybody can go on there and find unclaimed property. We've identified several legislators who actually have some unclaimed property sitting in our account, and we've been talking to them one-on-one and getting their claim forms filled out and their assets returned to them. But we don't say that if it's, you know, $10 or $40 that we're going to ignore it. We make that information available.
And Paul, do the banks and say, well, credit unions have to report any balance to you? Like even if it's $1.11 or...
Mr. Chair, for the record, Jeanette Holman from the Department of State Lands. Under a minimum amount, if the amount they're reporting is less than, I believe, $50, they can report it in the aggregate, so they don't have to line item for each person. They often send us their records, however, so that if those people show up, we can identify them, but they're not actually... reported by person.
Just for the record, I went through your website on about 10 former staff, and I did get one hit, and so I notified her. But unfortunately, it was under $50. So, any additional questions? Okay, go on to the next one.
So, second other request is when our budget went through the process, I think the assumption was that there would continue to be emergency boards, and I think that question has not been resolved yet, but we have programs that rely on grants and taking advantage of grant opportunities as they come up. And so we have a request for additional federal fund and other fund limitation to allow South SLU, which is our program that is very heavily dependent on grants, for both their construction and acquisition grants, which are annual grants that they receive from NOAA, as well as other funds limitation to take advantage of the Gustafson Trust account, which is the money that was bequeathed to South SLU for the purposes of acquiring additional lands, and also some small grant opportunities and contract opportunities that they get with state agencies. And so that's a request for limitation for things that we've identified as very real opportunities. And then the third is carryover limitation, and we've provided to staff a list of the carryover limitation that we believe we've got a number of federal grants that will carry over into the next biennium, and not to mention the big one, which is the new CARISA limitation for the removal of the new CARISA in 2008. And with that, Mr. Chair, that completes our presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any additional questions.
Are there any additional questions? Okay, if you'll be at ease for a second.
I actually have one.
Yeah.
Regarding the FTE, is that, do you see a continuing need, or how far do you see down the road? It could be 10 years, I know, before they even get close to a settlement. So do we anticipate that these FTE will be needed until that issue is resolved? Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, at least some of them, whether all of them are or not, I think it depends on the ebb and flow of the work as the whole Superfund discussion moves forward. It may be that we need, actually, if the record of decision is going to get pushed back, it may mean that we need less staff up front and we would need more staff later on.
Ms. Soliday, it appears at this point that the only item that we have left is the performance measures on the policy option packages themselves. How long do you envision that taking?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was trying to sort of included those in the slides that I went through at the bottom. That it shows each of the key performance measures that is touched to, that those are tied to. But I can go into more detail on those.
Why don't you see how far you can get over the next 15 minutes and just keep going until I get a question from one of the members.
Okay.
Okay.
Let us know where. I'm going to work from the section that says policy option packages in your notebook. So the first policy option package, which is our existing staff and continuing those, you'll see that those are important staff for us to meet our existing performance measures in a number of areas. First, increasing our revenues into the Common School Fund, increasing the annual revenue from our real estate, since two of those positions are our asset management positions. The net revenue from our escheated estates, and that's because two of the positions there are our estate staff. Getting completed resource inventories. This package includes our three seasonals, and those are the folks who actually do those resource inventories out on the ground. And you'll notice that we are expecting to have an additional 5% of those resource inventories completed each year over the biennium. And then also getting additional management plans completed once those resource inventories are completed. And so you'll see also we're proposing increases in our targets for those completed management plans. And then you'll notice we've identified some other, we've got internal targets for the asset management plan in particular, and there's a list of those identified in the other impact section as we're trying to implement the asset management plan around state. So we want a complete transfer of 36% additional lands in lieu selections into the Common School Fund. We want to complete the sale or exchange of 10% of those scattered forest lands in this next biennium. We also want to complete the disposal and evaluation of scattered range lands, about 20% of those prepared for sale or exchange in the next biennium. We want to complete the investment and disposal strategies for 30% of the lands that are classified as industrial, commercial, and residential. We've got a number of those in Central Oregon. We're trying to figure out whether we want to develop those ourselves or whether we want to sell them to other folks who would develop. And we also want to complete 50 to 100% of our special area management plan. Most of those are Central Oregon plans and our range lands. So we've got a number of internal goals that we want to achieve. In addition, for the estates program, we've already talked about the fact that the workload is continuing to increase exponentially, one of the big goals for this next biennium is to continue the outreach and education efforts so that we get all of the counties and state in compliance with the estate's requirements for those who die without a will and heirs and known heirs in the state of Oregon. So there are a number of performance measures that are impacted by this package, as well as some internal targets that we're trying to meet.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And just one more time, I'm just trying to go back to several days ago here. On performance measure one, when we essentially missed the target, so 05, we were at 20 million, target of 16, 06, we were at 12 million, target of 16. That's back where we were talking about the dramatic decline in collections due to a $10 million drop in revenue, and that's where we missed our target. Largely.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clem, that is a result of reduced revenue from the Elliott State Forest. Yep.
I my all yes. My ribbons here.
Yep. Policy Action Package 2, these are limited duration positions that we currently have, and this package would continue those limited duration positions. These are all funded by grants. Five of the staff are funded with Environmental Protection Agency grants, and the other two are funded through an interagency agreement with the Oregon Department of Transportation. They are assumed to be continued within our existing key performance measures. We do... So they cover the no net loss of wetlands. We have two of the staff who are involved in voluntary wetland restoration program funded by the Environmental Protection Agency. The permit decisions within our statutory timelines is our effort under the statewide programmatic general permit effort to streamline the federal authorizations that are needed in association with removal fill projects into the state, and we are continuing that effort. And the goal there is to make sure that we've got 100% of our permit applications process within the statutory requirements. And the third area that we're working towards improving is on our customer service area and the permit streamlining efforts that we're engaged in are very much directed towards improving customer service for our applicants. And you'll notice that we are proposing an increase in the targets for the customer service targets that are the sort of standardized customer service targets that all agencies are using. POP 103, which again is continuation of existing staff at South SLU. These are the positions at South SLU, eight of them that are funded through the federal grant. Several key performance measures there that we're trying to improve our customer service as well as the South SLU. We have three South SLU performance measures, key performance measures, and you'll remember that last week I talked about a proposal to combine 16 and 17 into a new key performance measure that would be more outcome-based than output-based. And you've got the targets for that new one, which would be to have 6%, 8%, and then 10% of the work that SALSNI does in education and research being used by decision-makers and others to solve problems affecting coastal estuaries in Oregon. And the last one is the leveraging of the Common School Fund and the federal funds to bring in additional other funds to try and reduce over time the amount of Common School Fund resources that support that program. And SALSLU has got a whole set of internal measures as a result of their management plan that they have to do every 5 years for NOAA as a part of the National Estuarine Research Reserve Program. And so they've got a number of actions and a number of individual targets that are laid out in their management plan that they are trying to meet over the next 5 years. And so there are, in addition to the key performance measures, a whole nother level of performance measures that they are trying to meet through the federal program.
Any additional questions at this time? Ms. Soliday, why don't we stop for today at this point? Tomorrow morning we will go through the remaining performance measures that are specifically related to the packages, which is one thing that the co-chairs have asked us to go through in every committee meeting, and then we will go on to some other things relative to efficiencies and potential 2% reductions and some ideas you might have there where those 2% reductions can come from. And with that, if everyone will please be back here tomorrow morning at 8:30, if things proceed smoothly, I should be able to find an extra 45 minutes for you tomorrow, and we should be through by about 9:15. With that, we are adjourned for the day.